Our final speaker today is Professor Angie Hobbs, who is Professor of the Public Understanding of Philosophy at the University of Sheffield, a position she has held since 2012 and was created for her. Her chief interests are in ancient philosophy and literature, and ethics and political theory from classical thought to the present, with an emphasis on the ethics and politics of flourishing. She's published widely in these areas, including her book Plato and the Hero from Cambridge University Press in 2000, and her most recent book is Plato's Republic, a Ladybird expert book, which came out last year. Angie has long worked in a wide variety of fora promoting more philosophy provision in schools and is an honorary patron of the Philosophy Foundation. She regularly contributes to TV and radio programs, as well as other media, and she's spoken at the World Economic Forum at Davos, the Houses of Parliament, the Scottish Parliament, and Westminster Abbey. Her guest media appearances include Desert Island Discs, Private Passions, and Test Match Special. She was a judge of the Man Booker International Prize last year, and she has recently been exploring the ethical challenges of COVID-19 or the Aspen Foundation. And we are delighted to host her today to give a talk entitled Virtues, Flourishing, and Education in an Age of Uncertainty. Over to you, Angie.
Oh, thank you so much, John. It's really lovely to be here and to be with you all. I hope you're all really well. It's also completely terrifying to be speaking after a talk about how to model and not model certain virtues in philosophy. Straight off, these are stocks you see behind me. I wish you could smell them. Those are my flower of choice. They're more to sort of relax me than anything else. Before I start my talk, just to pick up what Brendan has just said, it really took me back to my own philosophical training, which was at Cambridge in the 1980s as both an undergraduate and a graduate. And my goodness, there were some really terrible qualities being modelled by some of the lecturers and the guest speakers. I particularly remember the Moral Sciences Club, really the Immoral Sciences Club, which was a terrifying space with blood was expected to be on the carpet normally of the visiting speaker. But on one occasion, the visiting speaker, I recall, fought back against the wolves lined up against him and said to one of the particularly rude questioners, "Are you proud of the achievements of your profession?" And that chilling phrase has stayed with me. And I have always tried to be part of a philosophical community where we can at least try to be proud of what we're doing and how we're doing it. But my goodness me, Brendan, all the talks have given us a huge amount to think about, and I will try to refer to some of them in my talk now. So what we've heard three terrific accounts of what kind of virtues are needed to do good philosophy, and how we might model those in the classroom, and what kind of impact those virtues might have on wider society. Now, I've started from a rather different space, a rather different point, though I think I'm going to end up in a fairly similar position, because I've started off by asking what kind of virtues do we need right now in the wider community, in the profoundly uncertain and challenging times, turbulent times indeed, in which we live. And then I want to go on to ask whether philosophy, the study and teaching of philosophy, can help us understand these virtues better and how they might fit into a flourishing life, both for the individual and the community. And also even whether the teaching and study of philosophy can help us instill and foster these virtues. And if so, what kind of methods will be best suited to doing that? And of course, if we start talking about methods, we need to adapt those methods themselves to the uncertainty of the times, and in particular to the fact that for the foreseeable future, at least, online teaching is going to be more a part of our daily lives than it has been so far. So that's the rough plan. What kind of virtues do we need now to deal with this age of uncertainty? Can philosophy help us understand them and even instill them? And if so, what kind of methods might be best suited to doing that? I think there are four main virtues, or at least sets of virtues, that I want to concentrate on. And they're interconnected, as we will find out. Firstly, resilience. We really, really need resilience right now, for a couple of reasons that I will go on to explore in a moment. Secondly, we need mental agility and an ability to adapt quickly to changing circumstances and to deal with uncertainty. Thirdly, we need imagination and creativity. And fourthly, we need empathy and compassion. And you might think, you might be immediately asking yourselves, well, she's talking about we need resilience and we need adaptability. Don't they work against each other? Well, they might, but I don't think they necessarily do. And I'm going to help try to explain why I think that need not be the case, and that certain kinds of adaptability can go hand in hand with a resilience and a willingness to hang on to truth and argument and reason. So first, let's look at resilience, because my goodness me, we really are living in turbulent times. We have got the pandemic to deal with. We have climate change, the destruction of wildlife, pollution. We have political and economic upheaval, and we have the very necessary struggles for social equality and cultural equality that we're dealing with right now, such as Black Lives Matter and the Me Too movement. So there's a huge amount of change and turbulence going on. There's a lot of uncertainty. And we have these great cries and battles for social justice. So on top of that, so I'm trying to think how to phrase this best. On top of that, we have attacks, including from some politicians, on the importance of, indeed in some cases, even on the very notion of objective fact, evidence, reasoned argument, truth and truthfulness. We have all sorts of sophists attacking what we believe in philosophy on all sides. What do we need? We need to hang on, I think, to notions of objective fact and reasoned argument and truth and truthfulness in the face of all this. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't scrutinise claims to objective fact. Of course, all such claims should be scrutinised. But that is different from getting rid of the very notion of the possibility of fact and evidence and reason and argument. So we need to hang on to that. We need clear values, and we need, I think, a sound and durable and clear picture of what a flourishing life might look like, both for the individual and for the community again, and how different values and different virtues might fit into that picture. And again, I'll be saying a little bit more about that later. This doesn't mean that our picture of a flourishing life has to remain the same forever, ossified in time. Of course not. What I'm going to argue for is that we need a sound framework to do with, I would say, the actualizing of different human faculties and potentialities. But the canvas of the picture will need, of course, retouching from time to time, maybe even repainting according to changing times, altered facts, not alternative facts, but altered facts, new evidence. So we need these things to hang on to. We need something that's going to anchor us to a belief in the importance of reasoned argument based on evidence, and we need something. We need a clear and sound picture of what it might be to live a flourishing life as a human being. Now, the fact that the canvas may need retouching and repainting from time to time, of course, leads us to our second set of virtues, which is mental agility and adaptability. Because clearly at the moment, there are so many things changing so fast, and so many things that we simply don't know with any precision. We do not know what the precise course of this pandemic is going to be. We don't know precisely yet what are the best treatments or when a vaccine will be available. We're making progress, but there's a lot we don't know. We don't know whether there are going to be second waves, whether it will spike again. We don't know about future pandemics, different pandemics. We don't know the precise course of climate change. We don't know exactly what methods are going to be best to limit that, to limit global warming, to limit the destruction of our wildlife. We don't know the effects of both climate change and the pandemic on jobs, on future jobs and job security, on working and living conditions. We don't know how they're going to impact on social inequalities. We don't know how they're going to impact on what we feel about globalization, and indeed how they'll impact on the rise of populist nationalism and authoritarianism that we're seeing around the world at the moment. So masses that we know that we don't know, and to quote the ghastly Rumsfeld, there's also so many things that we don't even know that we don't know. So a lot of uncertainty. However, there's one thing we know with absolute clarity. And precisely because of all this uncertainty, we do know that our present and future workers, and indeed livers, not just workers, are going to need to be able to adapt very quickly, and they're going to need to be able very swiftly to understand what the changing circumstances are. They're going to need to grasp very quickly what might be good about the new circumstances and how best to make use of that. We're going to need workers and livers who are going to also need to be able to understand what's bad about the new situation and whether it can be changed, whether we can alter what's bad, and if we can't change it or get rid of it, can we modify it? And if we can't even do that, how do we best cope with it and adapt to it? So we need this mental suppleness and agility. And as I said, that does not go against the need for resilience, because it's not that I'm saying, oh, you must change your mind and you must change your set of values with every new idea that floats into your social media. No, absolutely not. As we were hearing from Laura, you need to be able to sift through all this new stuff coming in and work out what has evidence and reason behind it. And to pick up one of the questions that was asked from the audience, you need to have some discernment about which sources that you trust. So resilience, one set of values and virtues, and then mental agility and suppleness of mind and the ability to adapt. Now, the ability to adapt and think with agility in turn, of course, requires imagination and creativity, because we need both of these to reflect on what kind of society we want to be part of, what kind of society we want to help to create. And to use the current jargon, we need to work out how do we rebuild better. And of course, this positive, optimistic approach of trying to use this current uncertainty and time of change and turbulence to rebuild better always needs to be tempered by a realistic appreciation of the fact that many people are really suffering right now in this turbulence. And indeed, you and your families and friends, your colleagues, your students may be among those really suffering right now, and certainly millions of others that you don't know. So we need an appreciation of that and an empathy and a compassion with what people are going through right now, including your own students. So there we've got our four sets of virtues: resilience, mental agility and adaptability, imagination and creativity, and empathy and compassion. And as you can see, I hope they are all interlinked. But the good news is that the study and teaching of philosophy, both in schools and in higher education, at least has the potential to help us understand these sets of virtues better. And also, I think, can help instill and foster them. I say it has the potential to do this very deliberately, because as we've seen only too vividly this afternoon, done badly, modelled badly, philosophy can make things worse. I have seen it make things worse for people in my own life. So I'm not denying that, I'm not in denial about it, but I'm for the rest of my talk, I'm concentrating on the positive potential. So how might philosophy do this? Well, let's start with resilience. Now, clearly the process of sifting out true from false claims and beliefs and turning true beliefs into knowledge through, for example, the Socratic Elenchus, that's just one possible method, can clearly make one more resilient to the blandishments and the threats of latter-day sophists, the mountebanks and the charlatans peddling the false news and the alternative facts that Laura was discussing so eloquently. I think quite often there's a really vivid passage at the end of Plato's dialogue, the Meno, that I'm sure many of you know. The character of Socrates is asked to distinguish between having a true belief and having knowledge. And he says, well, the thing about a true belief is that though it's true, obviously, it's unstable. It's not fixed down because you don't understand the cause, the reason why, the aitia in the Greek. And because of that, because you don't understand why it's true, you can easily be talked out of it. You can read the next article and be persuaded by the next article you read, which contradicts it, even though the next article is false. But you think, oh, of course, so-and-so's got it right. You can easily be swayed by the latest thing in your social media feed. You can forget it. It's not stable. It is like, Socrates says, one of the statues of the mythical sculptor Daedalus, the mythical originator of sculpture, and he allegedly in the myth made statues that moved. It's not tied down by a reasoned understanding of the cause. When you get that understanding of the cause, then true belief is turned into knowledge. And because you know why it's true, that is much more secure and you're not going to be talked out of it. So philosophy can clearly help with this kind of resistance against sophistry. And I also think philosophy can provide a good life craft in stormy seas by encouraging both students and indeed teachers to think about what a flourishing life, a good life, a flourishing life might look like, both for an individual and a community. What kind of human faculties, potentialities would need to be realized for that life to be a flourishing life, and what kind of social and cultural and political conditions would need to be in place to achieve this. And philosophy, I think, further invites us to consider the nature of the values and virtues that might be needed to build this flourishing life. What is their role in a flourishing life? And whether particular virtues are still relevant in changing and changed circumstances, as you'll know from Nietzsche's genealogy of morals. I mean, he certainly has a view that virtues, you know, can go in and out of fashion, and certainly they can go in and out of fashion. That doesn't mean to say they're not necessarily needed, but it's worth thinking about. And even if they're still relevant, members of the audience was talking earlier about courage, and I absolutely agree that courage is hugely important in philosophy as it is in life. And I've recently written a couple of papers about the nature of courage and heroism in World War One, and how the extraordinary, relentless, new kind of industrialized mass warfare of World War One actually did and should change our view of how to define courage and heroism. So even if you stick with the name of the virtue, you might cash it out differently. And of course, it's exactly this kind of study of the nature of the virtues, of how they relate to understanding and how all that fits in with flourishing, that is at the core of the work of the Forum for Virtue and Understanding at the University of Hertfordshire. And we're so grateful to them and to Eton for putting this conference on today. So in terms of both those kinds of fields of resilience, in terms of giving us some kind of picture of a flourishing life to hang on to and how the virtues fit into that, and in giving us the ability to resist sophistry and fake news, philosophy can clearly be very, very useful. And testing the concepts in philosophy, testing concepts, testing premises and arguments in dialogue and debate, can of course also help with our swiftness of thinking, with our mental agility, with our suppleness. Done well, not like at the moral sciences at Cambridge in the 1980s, but I'm sure it's a different body now, but done well, that kind of debate and dialogue is the absolute lifeblood of philosophy and can really help progress the subject if people are working to search for the truth together in a collaborative effort and not trying to show that they're cleverer than anybody else by how fast or how slow they speak. Also, of course, that kind of mental agility and suppleness it's also going to lead to a kind of open-minded willingness to consider new facts, new evidence, fresh arguments. Do you need to revise your set of beliefs or not? Not just be a straw in the wind, not go with every new fashion, but look at the evidence carefully, listen to the arguments. Have you actually got it wrong? There's a wonderful line in a Leonard Cohen song, I think it's Tower of Song, but you can correct me, please, if I'm wrong. There's a mighty judgment coming, but I could be wrong. Fabulous Cohen poetry. And I think every philosopher and probably every politician should have it on the wall of their office. There's a mighty judgment coming, but I could be wrong. We could all be wrong. So philosophy can, done well, help with resilience, help with mental agility, and an adaptability to new situations. And that formatting, and also philosophy, in the way that it encourages us to formulate examples, counterexamples, hypotheses, whole thought experiments, all that work, of course, stimulates creativity and imaginative understanding, that there are different ways of thinking, living, and being than those immediately on offer in our own postcode. It extends the range of possible lives in ways that Laura was discussing so eloquently. Because of course, though philosophy is fantastic at honing our rational powers and our powers of analysis and argumentation, it is also, or can be, a terrific engine for creativity and imagination. Indeed, simply coming into contact with a wide and broad and diverse range of philosophers, including those of the past, I think can do this. And I think that's part of what Brendan was discussing, this importance of being exposed to a diversity of thought to get you out of your own social media echo chamber. And this imaginative understanding can, and again, there's no guarantee that it will always lead in this direction, but it certainly can increase our empathy with and our compassion for the experiences of others. Now, the fact that philosophy often works best through dialogue, through debate, can of course in turn help foster empathy and compassion. And it can also reduce isolation and anxiety, which is clearly important in itself, but also it's important because isolation, a sense of isolation, of being cut off from the group in the way that Brendan was discussing, that kind of sense of, oh, I'm excluded, this isn't really for me, and the kind of anxiety that that can go along with, those things impede philosophy. They do not help us to good philosophy. They impede the epistemic virtues that Peter was discussing at the beginning of the afternoon. So here we have four sets of virtues which are needed badly right now, and which the study and teaching of philosophy at least have the potential to help instill and foster. And the reason they can help it foster this is also partly, as we said at the outset, because philosophy can help us understand these virtues, why they're needed, how they fit in to a flourishing life, why societies need them. Both during our school and university days, but also afterwards. Okay, so if all this is at least potentially true of philosophy, then how do we teach it? Well, what are the best methods? Well, I mean, the resilience, as we've seen, I think, in the form of the ability to resist sophistry and fake news, should flow pretty naturally, pretty much as a matter of course, from sound scrutiny of philosophical concepts and arguments, as indeed should mental agility and suppleness. Imagination and creativity may well be fostered naturally too, although teachers may want to supplement the syllabus, depending of course on what the syllabus is, they may want to supplement it with some conscious inclusion of thought experiments and the like to encourage, to bring out, to draw out the creative potential of philosophy. Critically, and again, of course, it depends on the syllabus you've got, the teachers may want to supplement the syllabus with some discussion of what a flourishing individual and communal life might look like and how the virtues might fit into it. I mean, I actually think that's one of the very most important things that we can teach children in their education generally, whether they're studying philosophy formally or not. Now, I know you might think, well, she's biased, she specialises in the ethics and politics of flourishing. But the reason I've chosen to specialise in this area is precisely because I think it is so fundamental to everything else. And the potential of the study of teaching of philosophy to foster empathy should also follow, at least in part, to some degree, from open-ended questioning, from dialogue, from the thought experiments, from simple exposure to different ways of thinking and being. However, we need to recognize that online teaching and study is not only the current norm, but is, even after the worst of the pandemic is over and we're back at school, online teaching, I think, is likely to play a bigger role in teaching and study in the future. Not just because of possible future pandemics or spikes in this pandemic, but also because of reasons, environmental reasons and economic reasons. So I think this is a fact we've got to start adapting to. And as you all know, online teaching presents particular challenges as well as some opportunities, I think. Now, all of you attending, will, I'm sure, have your own experiences and ideas here, and I'm looking forward to hearing from about them in the Q&A. So I'm just going to give end with a couple of tentative suggestions. It seems to me, from my experience so far, that because as online, obviously as a teacher, you are more physically remote, of course, that can possibly give rise to feeling, you know, that the teacher is more remote in other ways. despite chat rooms, despite Q&A, it can, depending on the forum, feel a bit harder to question the teacher. And that potentially gives the teacher a lot more power. Although, to be fair, of course, it's also much easier for students just simply physically to leave the room. They can just go and you can't stop them. Certainly, the teacher has more power in that they can mute. They can select the questions. Right, today, John has all the power. He can mute any of us whenever he wants. So there are real issues to do with power and to do with the more apparently formal environment of online teaching that we need to think hard about. So I think we need to take particular care with tone, with humour, with addressing the kinds of things that Brendan was addressing, in terms of how we appear. It's not just how we think we appear, but what do the students actually see? How do we come over? Do we appear human and relatable? Do you want to maybe show them a little bit more of your house, your room, that they can see from your carefully staged books and flowers? You could show them your laundry basket, for instance. Now, I've taken the precaution of removing my laundry basket, which was in this room this morning, but here's a little bit of the absolute chaos of all the papers on the bed in the study. So that's out of shot. So I have this all carefully set up because I'm doing lots of interviews at the moment, and I always have my flower. I like flowers. I'm happy with that. And I have my books, and I've sort of checked there are no really embarrassing books behind me. But, you know, just think a little bit about that. Even more attention needs to be paid than normal to establishing a warm and inclusive atmosphere in which students feel able to question, able to challenge. An atmosphere that's relaxed and yet attentive. These are real challenges, and I think if we think even harder about including questioning, including debates, and having the courage, that word again, the courage to include 1 or 2 minutes of silence in our lectures and our classes, for students to think for themselves, to give them space, to take a bit of that power away from the teacher. I won't do it now because of the time constraints, but you get the idea. So to sum up, we are currently living in a very uncertain and turbulent world for a lot of reasons, not just the pandemic, and it's likely to remain that way for some time. Let's start with thinking, what kind of virtues does the world need right now? Can philosophy teach them? Yes. Is philosophy teaching them? That will vary depending on lots of things, but let's think consciously on how we can increase the potential of philosophy to teach these virtues that are so relevant. And we need to recognize that because of the turbulence, because of the move to online teaching that has engendered, we need to be particularly thoughtful about how we teach and study philosophy, not just in terms of content, but also in terms of tone. So thank you very much, and lovely to be here, and stay safe.
Thank you very much indeed, Angie. That was wonderful. Extremely interesting and positive, optimistic notes about the future of philosophy and its role there, and great to reflect on the day's talks in those ways. Thank you so much. Okay, our first question here is from Will Ord, and Will Ord asks, values are common foci in schools, and these are often conflated with virtues. Would you be able to describe how virtues, which he notes have so far not been defined in this conference, relate to values, and why schools might need to start taking virtues more seriously?
Well, I'm sure all my fellow panelists will have different answers to this. So if a value is something, some quality, some aim, some objective, something that you care about, something that you literally value, then the virtue would be the disposition, I would say, the set of characteristics, the disposition, I go with an Aristotelian definition of virtue here, the disposition in your character that would help you achieve those values. So, of course, on that, values and virtues are going to differ according to culture and to times.
Great.
Sorry, what was the second part of the question again?
Let me pull it back up. Describe how virtues relate to values and why schools might need to start taking virtues more seriously.
Okay, well, if the virtue is the set of the dispositional set of characteristics that are going to help you achieve the values, then they've obviously got a real practical you know, that whether you believe in a God or not, human societies have developed concepts of virtues for reasons that we think they help us achieve certain things that as individuals and communities we want to happen, that we value. So we value courage, at least in others, if not in ourselves, because we think it will help to save us in times of danger, even if that's somebody else's courage saving us. So I would say that you need to have an understanding of what you value, an understanding of what you regard as good and worth valuing before you can work out your sense of what qualities, what characteristics, what dispositions of character are going to help you achieve that. That's why whenever I'm asked, am I a virtue ethicist? I always say I'm a flourishing ethicist, because for me, though the two are interconnected and sometimes identical in reference, if not in sense, for me, the notion of the values, the flourishing, what you regard as good comes first. And then the nature of the virtue that will help you achieve that, it flows from that. So I think it would help just as part of anybody's education, whether they're in a philosophy class or not, to be encouraged to reflect throughout your education, what do you value? Why do you value it? Should you be valuing it? If you should be valuing it, if it's a good thing to value, what kind of dispositions of character are going to be useful in helping achieve that?
Great, thank you very much, Angie, and thank you, Will, for that question. The next question is, could you please say a bit more about how public philosophy might have a role to play in promoting intellectual virtues within society?
Whoa. Okay. Well, the reason, I mean, I had a chair in the public understanding of philosophy at Sheffield from 2012. And before that, for 3 years, something like senior fellow or something in the public understanding of philosophy at Warwick. And the reason I wanted to go for those roles was because I truly believe that most people are brighter than they think they are, certainly brighter than they've often been led to believe in school, and that intellectual virtues are, in my view, we haven't got time to go into it here, but actually inextricably linked to virtues of character. People have got an unhelpful distinction from Aristotle on the moral virtues and the intellectual virtues. In fact, if you read Aristotle, he links the two really, really closely. And that intellectual virtues are absolutely crucial to helping us all achieve, you know, more flourishing lives as a group. In fact, we'll die as a human race. We will literally die out as a human race without them. And that there is a lot of the work I do and that others in the public understanding of philosophy do is to help people use their own, you know, think through things for themselves. I mean, I don't want to teach anybody what to think or how to live, but I want to help people think through those things for themselves in ways that I believe pretty much everybody can do, but some people maybe don't have the confidence to do, haven't had the training to do, haven't been encouraged to do, it just hasn't occurred to them to do. So for me, yes, I think it's a very important part of the work that I do, and it's simply encouraging everybody to fulfill their own intellectual potential.
Great, thank you very much, Angie, and thank you for that question. The next question is from Alice Moneypenny, who asks, to what extent do you think it is possible to make blanket statements about which virtues are needed at the moment? For some students, they may already have a great deal of resilience, But right now, given their circumstances, it doesn't really address the particular difficulties they're facing. Should we instead be contextualist about the kinds of virtues we think are important to particular individuals in particular circumstances?
Oh, yes, of course. I wasn't trying to give a blanket statement. I think I said here are four sets of virtues that I think are particularly important right now. That it's not meant to be exclusive by any means, and it may be different next year, and it will need to be adapted to particular individual circumstances and lives, of course. You're giving, you know, a general statement, but again, to go back to Aristotle, you need to adjust it to particular circumstances. I want to stand by the resilience thing. Of course, it's not going to be enough for a lot of people to flourish. That we need certain political virtues to be in place, which may not be so in evidence at the moment. A lot of people's circumstances, they're certainly not going to be fixed by resilience, mental agility, creativity and empathy. That won't be enough to fix them. Lots of other things in society need to be in place. But I can't think of anybody being harmed or their situation being made worse by having these sets of virtues at the moment. I really can't. I think everybody would benefit from practicing these virtues at the moment, though I absolutely agree they are not going to be enough to fix a lot of people's problems, and that we need to be looking at the political and social circumstances in which they're living and adjusting accordingly. Mm-hmm. So the basic answer to your question is, I wasn't trying to be blanket. Yes, it was slightly broad because of the constraints of time, but of course you adapt to particular circumstances.
Great. Thank you, Angie. And thank you for that question, Alice. To follow on that question, Angie, do you think the kind of resilience that we should be teaching to students and fostering among students right now should be of a particular kind related to the current difficulties we face, and perhaps also some virtues? So, for example, should students be taught a certain kind of long-term resilience be promoted, grit, for example? And in the case of intellectual virtues, perhaps we should be focusing a bit more on long-term thinking to address the particular challenges we face, such as climate change and so on. Do you think there are virtues like that we should emphasize more, or the kind of character of certain virtues changes in response to the current challenges we face and the ones we're going to face ever more so after COVID-19?
Yes, I mean, as I was sort of saying in my example about the way I think the actual definitions of courage and heroism in particular, can or at least should be altered because of the circumstances of World War One. You've got your sturdy frame of the picture of flourishing life. So you have a sturdy frame around the virtue, but the actual painting of the picture of the virtue will depend, you know, alter a little through time. That seems to be slightly different from the point you were making about whether we should be instilling long-term virtues. So, I mean, certainly I think resilience and imagination and compassion and things are things, you know, these are things we need throughout life. They will need to be practiced and exhibited in slightly different ways. And that's why they are interconnected. You need the intellectual understanding of how the circumstances are changing to know exactly how you exhibit these virtues at these particular moments. That I have a feeling I haven't quite got to the nub of your question here. I have a feeling I've not quite understood the nub of your question.
Well, no, I think you've answered it. I mean, I guess something I was getting at was that I don't think there's certain... I don't think there's maybe a different set of virtues we need to foster amongst students, given current crises we face, COVID-19 and climate change being the two, perhaps two biggest ones. But perhaps there are certain skills students need to be taught more in light of these, such as a greater capacity for long-term thinking about the long-term consequences of certain actions that we do right now. A higher degree perhaps of counterfactual reasoning, you know, if we don't do this is what could happen. Yes. And perhaps a certain kind of resilience, which I suppose I roughly described as grit there. I mean long-term resilience, because these are things which require, well, a constant effort throughout our lifetimes and are not going to go away.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Okay. I think I've got that. Yes. So I've long thought, because we're often told that sort of people born after a certain year, I won't say what year, and are less sort of politically minded or less inclined to favour a particular political party. And actually, I think that's changed a lot in the last 4 or 5 years. But it certainly used to be said about 10 years ago. But even then, even at the stage maybe in the early 2000s when young people were less interested in party politics, they were still hugely interested in environmental movements, for instance, precisely because they could see that longer term thinking was required than the kind often offered by political parties, which have the sort of the vice of short-termism kind of built into the system. Mm-hmm. And I think that has absolutely increased. So we're seeing, in fact, people of all generations, and particularly young people, develop immensely commendable long-term perspectives in terms with the fight against racial injustice, gender injustice, and climate change, and so on.
Great. Thank you so much again, Angie, for that wonderful talk and for responding to those questions in such detail. Okay. Thank you, everybody. Have a lovely Saturday evening. Goodbye.